episode 62 of the Blooms and Barnacles podcast. I'm Kelly.
And I'm Dermot.
Dermot, I am so excited about today's episode, I am going to just barrel right into it.
Good.
So we've got a really special one for you guys today. We have an interview between myself and one Mr. Vincent Altman O'Connor, whose work I became familiar with while researching this blog. Vincent, a few years back, published an article about a turn-of-the-century Dublin politician named Albert Altman, a.k.a. Altman the Saltman, who he is related to. It's his ancestor. And he believes that Albert Altman influenced Joyce in the creation of Leopold Bloom.
So he's yet another candidate for the identity.
Yes. In our previous episode, we named off a bunch of candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of skimmed over Albert Altman because today we have a full episode about Albert Altman and Altman family lore. And after this, you will know about as much as you could ever hope to about Albert Altman. It was a really fun conversation to be part of, and I think you're going to really enjoy it. Vincent is a very knowledgeable and very articulate speaker, and he is really good at presenting this information. I felt like listening back to this as I recorded or edited it this week, that I was very rambly talking to him, but I want to say I was about as starstruck as I ever get, because I read Vincent's article about his ancestor, which we'll link in our show notes. And I got really excited when I read it, and it sort of altered the course of that first article I wrote on our blog about the origins of Leopold Bloom. And then Vincent contacted me and said that people kept sending him that same article and he had thought it was really good and he'd like to talk to me. And that is thrilling to me. So thank you. I just want to say thank you to whoever is, if you're listening to, if you sent Vincent that, my blog post about who is the real Leopold Bloom, I really appreciate it because it culminated in a really great experience for me and I hope for Vincent as well. Okay, I'm getting rambly again. I don't want to say too much more. Just listen on. You're going to really enjoy this one, guys.
One more thing. If you want to watch the interview, we have it up on our YouTube channel. All you have to do, go to YouTube, type in Blooms and Barnacles. There's only one of us, and you'll find our channel there. I would suggest you subscribe to it. We don't do videos often, but when we do, they're kind of special.
Mm-hmm.
We don't just talk into the video camera or anything. So it'll have slides, and you'll get to see Vincent himself and mm-hmm. Kelly and... Not me, so don't worry. And so do that if you do have access to YouTube.
You see me in my Phil Harding t-shirt.
Time Team fans will appreciate that.
So yes, check that out. And that video will be embedded in our show notes as well. So if you typically only listen to this as audio only, you can go to our website, which is...
bloomsandbarnacles.com.
And you'll find our show notes under the blog tab. It's really easy to find. All right, so we've got a little bit of business and then we'll get right into this. Shout-outs this week. We'd like to thank our donor,
Ellen Murphy.
Thank you for donating. And if any other listeners out there would like to donate, how can they do that?
Just go to bloomsandbarnacles.com. There's a little button on the top right of the screen which will help you to send us some cash, which goes right into the podcast.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't have cash to donate right now, a really great way to help people find the show is to review us on Apple Podcasts. If you give us a good review, we will read it on the podcast. And if you give us a negative review, we will mock it off air. If you'd like to send us a compliment, a question, or a grievance, how can they reach us?
Through your email.
Yes.
bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. Is
yep.
that not?
Yep. bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. All spelled out. bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. Send us an email there and we'll read that as well. Or you can join our social media on Facebook or Twitter. You can find more information about that in the outro of the podcast. One more way, if you don't love social media, if you're like me, you can sign up for our newsletter and you can find that at the bottom of our homepage
at bloomsandbarnacles.com.
Right. And Vincent also very generously suggested some closing music for today's episode. So we're going to play a little extract of a song called A Lowly Peasant Girl by J.C. Doyle after he and I are done talking. And that'll lead you into the outro where you can get all of our contact info.
Great.
All right. Well, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Until then.
Bye.
Bye. All right. I'm really excited today to welcome Vincent Altman O'Connor to the Blooms and Barnacles podcast. I'm going to let him introduce himself here in a moment, but I just want to say that his writing has really changed the way I look at certain aspects of Ulysses. So I think for all you listeners out there, this is going to be a really interesting and maybe controversial conversation. So Vincent, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, first of all, Kelly, let me wish you a Caid Míle Fáilte good last name, and welcome to Glasnevin, the dead centre of Dublin. But I'm sure you've heard that that one before. my name is Vincent Altman O'Connor, yeah, and I'm a Dubliner. And I can tell you with a Jewish name like Altman and an Irish name like O'Connor, not to mention the fact that my grandfather worked at Dublin's cattle market, you won't be surprised to hear that I'm frequently asked questions about Leopold Bloom. And coincidentally, my partner, Colette, hails from County Limerick, and not too far from the village of Shanagolden. And she finds herself on occasions having to sidestep questions about the citizen and his reluctance to return home to his native parish. And until recently, or as Joyce himself might say, I cultivated the pluter-perfect imperturbability of the Department of Agriculture in Dublin, where I worked in Kildare Street. But I'm retired now, and in my spare time, I play the piano. And you might be interested to know that some years ago, I did a few gigs with Irish bluesman Don Baker in your hometown of Portland.
Oh, wonderful.
And it was a great 2 weeks, I can tell you. And further south in Corvallis lives my great friend Neil Davison, who's professor of English at Oregon State University. And Neil is regarded as one of the, you know, the leading lights in what has become known as Jewish Joyce. And you might have read his latest piece on Altman the Saltman in the Journal of Modern Literature last year, or 2019. Indeed, not too far away in Missoula, Montana, lives my other great friend, John Hunt, Professor Emeritus of English at the University of Montana. And John edits the Joyce Project, where I contribute to notes mm-hmm. on the Hiberno-Hebraic connection and on Fenianism and what I term Dublin psychotopography, but more of that later on.
Yes.
Which brings me, by a commodious vicus of recirculation, back to Glasnevin, and where I live, near the cemetery. So would you like to hear something about Glasnevin?
I would love to hear something about Glasnevin.
Our local pub is the Brian Boru House, which is at the top of the road. And as you know, it's mentioned in the Heydays episode. And then past the Botanic Gardens, up Washerwoman's Hill, stood the House of Delville, where Jonathan Swift visited his girlfriend Stella, or one of his girlfriends, Stella. And behind me here is Claude Road, where John Joyce spent his last years. And his funeral service, if you could see through that wall there, you would be looking at St. Columbus Church in Iona Road, where John Joyce's funeral service took place. And the church is kind of, it's opaquely mentioned in Finnegan's Wake. I think he calls it St. Columbus in the Fields, or something like that, which it was in the fields at the time. Further down this way, we have Drumcondra, where James Joyce said the best English was spoken, and he was correct in that, of course, we know that. And further down, we have the River Talca. But at the top of the road here, we have Crossguns Bridge, and that leads across into Phibsborough and to Pisser Dignam's Field. And Pisser Dignam's Field is now Daly Mount Park at St. Peter's Terrace, where May Joyce spent her last years. And of course, Daly Mount Park, as Dermot would know, Daly Mount Park is the home of Bohemians Football Club, Boas, as we call them. Come on, the Boas. In the 1890s, one of the great players for Bohemians was none other than Oliver St. John Gogarty.
Oh, wow.
And he lived down that away in Fairfield House.
Did you get interested in James Joyce and Ulysses because your neighborhood and your area of Dublin seems really like saturated with Joyce stuff?
Well, yeah, I'm surrounded by it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. One particular place which has a great meaning for us is the Talca River, which is down here. And on the north bank of the Talca was the ancient Sephardic settlement of Goose Green.
Oh, OK.
That may ring a bell if you're a reader of Ulysses. And in Goose Green is Ireland's oldest Jewish cemetery at Ballybock, where the Altman grave is quite conspicuous. On the south bank of the Talca, actually, is Dublin's suicide plot, would you believe?
Oh.
And Bram Stoker took a great interest in the suicide plot. Of course, he was born just a few minutes further up in Clontarf. And interestingly, the Joyce family had no fewer than four different residences on the periphery of Ballybock Jewish Cemetery. Hmm. So you asked me about getting interested in Ulysses.
Yes.
Look, I'm surrounded by it. If I step out my front door, I step onto page 96 of Ulysses. That's the first edition, to be precise.
Yes. All right.
So that's it in a nutshell, Kelly.
Your family has a particular connection to the world of Joyce and Ulysses through this character named Albert Altman, who I'm guessing most readers of Ulysses probably aren't familiar with that name if they're a casual reader. So could you tell us a little bit about him and his connection to the character of Leopold Bloom?
As you know, I have an article in the History Ireland magazine, which
yes.
gives you a potted history of Altman the Saltman. Now, I don't know if you have the time, I could kind of give you an even a reduced version of that.
I would love that.
It might take 5 or 6 minutes.
That would be perfect.
There's quite a bit out there. Frank McNally in the Irish Times has covered Altman quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend Neil Davison has just completed a critical biography of Altman. And that it probably won't be out this year, but that may be on your shelves next year.
Okay.
But if you want a potted history, I'll go for it.
Go for
it. Well, the Altmans arrived in Dublin in the early 1850s. And they came from what was then known as Prussian Poland. Although they may have spent some time in Hungary, but we're not sure about that. There was Moritz Altman, known as Moses the Tailor, and he was a milliner. And he and his wife, Deborah, settled in Dublin's Jewish neighbourhood, which was then in Capel Street. Now, Moritz was famous for his military headgear. He was a military tailor, and his creations are still to be viewed in the Imperial War Museum in London.
Oh, wow.
Such was his great skill in this particular field. Now, a few years later, he had a very talented son called Albert, who persuaded his father, Moritz, to set up a salt and coal importing business. And they moved to Pembroke Quay on the River Liffey because it was most suitable for the boats and barges. But in 1877, they hit the headlines for the first time when they were accused by Dublin's Lord Mayor, Hugh Tarpey, of using a faulty weighing machine. In other words, they were ripping off their customers. Now, incidentally, Tarpey's daughter, Emma, was godmother to Charlie Joyce, James's brother.
Okay.
James Joyce's brother. They were acquitted after a notorious trial which went on for weeks and months. But young Albert, this genius, he was convinced that he was the victim of anti-Semitism. And so he and his brother Mendel, they became Irish nationalists because they saw a parallel between the Irish struggle and the Jewish struggle. And of course, it wasn't long before the press reported their support for Parnell and their membership of the Land League. Now, as it happened, Albert was expelled from the Jewish community because he married out of the Jewish faith. He married a Catholic woman, Susan O'Reilly, in Cork. And her husband, her cousin, the Fenian Dennis F. Burke, was amongst those Fenians who had planned the cunning escape of James Stephens from prison.
Mm-hmm.
But ironically, Susan's brother Thomas was a chaplain in the British Army, and he was stationed for a time in Gibraltar. And he died from sunstroke, would you believe, after the Battle of Tel El Kebir in Egypt, where Sir Garnet Wolseley had defeated the Arabi Pasha. Now, the couple's firstborn was a girl. She was known as, she had loads of names, Mary Deborah, Mim, Mamie, or Mimi. And she was reputed to be Dublin's most beautiful woman. And she was a gifted singer and a pianist. But their second boy, Bertie, died shortly after birth. And that may ring a bell.
Yeah, there's a lot of familiar details in there.
Well, the Altmans lived at number 11 Usher's Island, and their vast salt warehouse was on Bridgeford Street, what's called at the top of the hill on Bridgeford Street, opposite St. Catherine's Church, where Robert Emmet had been executed in 1803. And their stables were in Island Street, just off Watling Street, which reminds you, I suppose, of Wandering Rocks. So, as you can imagine, it wasn't long before the Altmans came to the attention of Dublin Castle, the British authorities at Dublin Castle. And then their mother, Deborah, died, and she would be my great-great-grandmother, and she is buried in Ballybuck Jewish Cemetery that I mentioned earlier. And it all became too much for their aged father, Moritz, who by this time was blind, and he relocated to Aldershot military camp in England because he was a military tailor. And soon afterwards, a broken-hearted Moritz died after taking poison, and the coroner recorded death by misadventure. That might ring another bell with you. But back in Dublin, young Albert and Mendel became leading members of the Irish Home Manufacturers Association, where one of their comrades was James Carey, the Invincible later turned informer. And when the Invincibles assassinated the British officials Burke and Cavendish in the Phoenix Park, the Irish Home Manufacturers Association condemned the murders, but Albert was castigated for his peripheral association with the conspiracy. In fact, Joe Brady, who was hanged, mentioned Altman at the trial. And of course, from thence on, the Altmans were considered to be Fenian sympathisers. And a good few years later, in 1896, Albert hit the headlines yet again when he revealed that Dublin's Lord Mayor McCoy had not paid his taxes. Now, Albert had, by fair means or foul, he had managed to peruse the rates books for 1893. And this was the year, coincidentally, that John Joyce had been dismissed from the rates office for a so-called political offence. And Lord Mayor McCoy's spectacular fall from grace was described in the press as a crushing defeat. And after that, Albert's Catholic wife, Susan, died. And what did he do? Then he went off and married a Protestant, Victoria Olive Corbett, in Belfast. And Albert was 44 years of age and young Victoria was 17. And this, of course, created another scandal. And Victoria and Albert, as they were called, lived in Goldenbridge House in Chicor. And a plaque to Susan is displayed in the nearby Oblate Church, which should ring another bell. After that, they moved again to the upmarket Pembroke Road. And Mimi, that's the daughter, she never got on with her father's young wife, who was the same age practically. So she left, she moved out, and she moved to Strand Road in Sandymount. And next door would become the house of James and Greta Cousins, where, coincidentally, Joyce stayed. After many failed attempts, Albert Altman was eventually elected to Dublin Corporation in 1902. But although he was a member of the United Irish League, he was endorsed by the Labour Electoral Association and, amazingly, Arthur Griffith in the United Irishmen, much to the chagrin of John Redmond, who was leader of the Irish Parliamentary Party at Westminster. And he was elected. He was re-elected in 1903 after a very nasty anti-Semitic campaign. And he voted against the address of welcome to King Edward VII. And he hit the headlines yet again. I mean, he was never out of the headlines when he sensationally accused Dublin's leading politicians of not paying their rates. And just as these politicians rushed to the rates office to settle their debts, Albert Altman was reported dead. and his funeral from Pembroke Road to Glasnevin is almost identical to Paddy Dignam's, and his grave is a few metres from Matthew Caine's. And he was succeeded on the corporation by his brother Mendel, who lived in Stony Batter. And Mendel's daughters were Sissy and Edie, and his son Emmanuel, who's my grandfather, he was an inspector at Dublin's cattle market, where his office, as he called it, was in the bar of the Sitting Arms Hotel. And my grandmother used to say, "Your granddad spends an awful lot of time in the office." We didn't understand what that meant for a while. Another son, Albert Joseph, was in the same class as James Joyce in O'Connell's schools. And shortly before he died in 1963, my grandfather, Emmanuel, his full name was Emmanuel Columbus Patrick Altman, or ECP. He was known as ECP. And speaking of the part played by his family in the Irish independence movement, he said, rather ruefully, "The Altmans never got the credit because they were Jewish, and nobody remembers them now." Shin shin.
Yeah, that's that. Interesting. So, as you pointed out yourself, there seems to be a lot of parallels and well-known names, certainly connected with Ulysses and Joyce. And, you know, rather than continuing to beat around the bush, I think the idea is that Albert Altman played he was sort of an inspiration for the character that would become Leopold Bloom. Like, obviously, there are a lot of people who are kind of rolled into Leopold Bloom. He's not a one-to-one.
Yes. He wouldn't be the only Irish Jew either. I mean, I'm fairly familiar with the history of the Irish Jewish community. And there's also in there is Joe Edelstein. There's Michael Noyack. There's Lewis Harris, who was elected. He was the first elected Jewish Lord Mayor of Dublin, but he died a day before taking office. There's many others. Bethel Solomons, whose father is mentioned in Ulysses. So it's quite a composite. And my take on the whole thing is that Altman the Sultan is simply part of the composite. I think there's two sides of the coin. There's the Irish Jews with, say, Altman at the top, and there's the Triestine Jews with Svevo at the top.
Yes.
But there are two sides of the same coin. I think I was speaking at the Trieste Summer School a few years ago, and I think the details of Bloom's life seem to chime with Altman.
Mm-hmm.
But I suspect his personality is more Svevo.
Yes. Yeah, I know when I was doing research on this topic long ago before it turned into a blog and a podcast, I would come across this quote from Padraic Colum, which seemed to be repeated by a lot of other commentators. And I'll read the quote, and it says, "It is odd that the creator of the most outstanding Jew in modern literature did not at that time know any of the Jewish community in Dublin. And what so fascinated me about your writing is that it's a direct disagreement, I guess, with that sentiment."
Oh, well, I wouldn't be the first, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I think Padraic Colum's thing was, his book was published in about 1957, perhaps.
Yeah.
But by the time that Lewis Hyman wrote A History of the Jews of Ireland in 1972, he was already contradicting Padraic Colum, because he listed off a series of Jews who Joyce was familiar with. But, I mean, Padraic Colum's comment it's very interesting, and he never elaborated or clarified it.
Right.
So if his intention was to steer attention away from on the Irish Jewish models, he certainly succeeded, because every article is prefaced by that particular quote. And, of course, there's a few strange things about it. He says at that time. Now, what time exactly is he referring to? I often wonder.
I own his book, so I read it in context, and he's talking about Joyce's younger years, maybe like his late teens or early 20s, when he would have been like a university student. So kind of when he really started writing in earnest, and when he was still living in Dublin full time.
Yeah, he also says that Joyce did not know. Does he mean know personally or know of?
He says there are a few, like, Jewish people that Joyce would have been acquaintances with, but they were, like, I don't know if, like, lapsed Jew is the right word, but they weren't particularly religious or culturally Jewish. And just his whole point is that Joyce didn't really know any Jewish people in Dublin, even though he's most famous for writing about a Dublin Jew. He met lots of Jews in Trieste, but not so much in Dublin.
Well, as I said, if, for example, Altman the Saltman was seldom out of the headlines, and Joyce was famous for making it his business to be informed about everything that happened in Dublin, how can we reconcile these two
right.
things, you know? And of course, the funny thing about Padraig Colum is that Padraig Colum introduced Joyce to Jews like the Sinclair brothers who are mentioned in Ulysses. And Padraig Colum actually lived in Little Jerusalem, and his back gate looked on to Bloom's fictional address in Clanbrassil Street. Mm. So I'm inclined to think that the real reason for that comment from Padraig Colum was that the threat of my own grandfather taking up to 1963 taking Joyce to court. I mean, it was a very strong possibility.
Hmm.
We had a regular visitor to our family, a gentleman called John D. Sheridan, who is a small-time writer. He was quite famous. He wrote one or two very interesting books, actually. The Intelligent Rabbit's Guide to Golf was one of his very famous books. But he was a very right-wing Catholic, and he visited my grandfather a lot. I remember him visiting the house. He'd bring me a packet of Tato crisps. I know Dermot's a great fan of Tato crisps.
Yes.
This was before Dermot's time, but in the early days, they came with a little sachet of salt. And of course, this was a great okay. trigger for conversation about salt. Mm. But he tried to get my grandfather to read Ulysses. But of course, my grandfather wouldn't have anything to do with James Joyce's smutty book. And eventually there was a row. Mm-hmm. And that was the last we heard of John D. Sheridan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, it seems like based on all that you've told us about Albert Altman so far, that you think there would be more recognition of him in scholarship around James Joyce and Ulysses. So why hasn't he been recognized more by scholars until recently?
Well, oh my goodness, how long have you got? You see, I mean, that immediately raises another question as to whether is it absolutely necessary that a reader know who a fictional character is based on whom it's based? I mean, there are those who'd say all you need to know about Leopold Bloom is between mm-hmm. the covers of Joyce's book. But of course, we encounter so many enigmas and puzzles in Ulysses that the reader is goaded and provoked into exploring the extra textual, you know, in the hope that the historical backdrop will yield up some vital clue. And, by the way, I have a wonderful quote for you on that. It's my all-time favourite quote. It's from Surface and Symbol, my favourite book on Joyce, by Robert M. Adams. And he says, in all one's thinking about social reality in Ulysses, unless I am badly mistaken, there glimmers before one the hope that if one digs a little deeper or explores a little farther, a special fact will emerge which draws everything together and causes all the disparate details now hanging in suspension to fall into sudden order. It is always conceivable that a new way of looking at Ulysses will be found, which at a stroke will reduce to miraculous harmony all the books and all the book's symbols. When this happens, the fellow who has called it impossible will look very silly indeed. Written in 1962, would you believe? So, I mean, we've spent nearly 100 years trying to find this special fact. That's if it exists at all. But in my view, it's to be found in the life lived of one of Joyce's real life models. And as you know, as you probably know, Vivian Igoe's book, The Real People of Joyce's Ulysses. This is a wonderful tome. It should be on everybody's shelf. She curiously enough lists Leopold Bloom as one of the real people.
That is curious.
Yes. Which means, of course, that for readers of Joyce, we must always be aware that the difference between fact and fiction is not so obvious. You have to read Ulysses and all Joyce's work with one foot in fact and the other foot in fiction, you know. And, you know, it's funny when you think about Vivian Igoe's book, because there are hundreds of fictional characters here who are based on real people. But why is there this sense of this lack of knowledge about Joyce's most profound characters? Now, we know who Stephen Dedalus is, but we're still struggling with who Leopold Bloom and Molly Bloom were. And, you know, why this coyness on Joyce's part? Now, I know the reason.
What is it?
The reason is obvious. Well, let's put it this way, and I hope I won't have to take the aeroplane to Salem, because Dermot might take me to court. But if I wrote a book about Dermot misbehaving on Cannon Beach in front of young ladies, I'm sure Dermot would love to see me in court. Yes.
Yeah.
We won't. I'm not casting any aspersions on poor old Dermo there now. But
your point is well made.
Yeah. It was imperative for Joyce that he snuff out any suggestion that Bloom was based on a living Irish Jew, many of whom, I can tell you, were very, very litigious people.
Was there? There was actually a libel case. Was it Reuben J. Dodd, I think, that went through the courts?
Well, that was 1957, and it was in the years after that, from about 58 to 63, that we had these visits from this gentleman writer that I was telling you about. But, you know, I think nowadays, I was just looking at an old Irish Times review of Vivian Igoe's book by Terence Killeen, and he's one of the great Bloom hunters, pun intended. And Terence Killeen says that Joyce's Rescue by Alfred H. Hunter is nothing but an old canard. So Terence, I suppose, is putting forward the view which has been added to recently by Mark A. Mamagonian in the James Joyce Quarterly, that from the get-go, Joyce had to conceal the identity of Leopold Bloom, because he would have ended up in court. And the case you mentioned, the Reuben J. Dodd case, a great friend of mine, Patrick Callan, has an article coming out in the Dublin James Joyce Journal, and he went to the BBC archives. You see, Dodd won a phenomenal sum of money from the BBC after they broadcast excerpts from Ulysses. But Patrick said to me, he said, you know, when I was at the BBC researching the Dodd case, what do I come across? Only their legal advice prior to the broadcast. And the BBC weren't, they didn't know much about poor old Dodd. The BBC were focused on, was there any descendants of the Blooms still alive? That was their main concern. So Patrick Callan's article, which will be an exceptionally important piece of work, will be coming out in the Dublin James Joyce Journal, I think the next edition. Worth the read.
Yeah, I'm excited to read that. That's very interesting. Okay. Has any of your research into Altman's life been controversial at all? Or has there been any pushback? Because I think, like, we mentioned Alfred Hunter, he's always been seen as like, oh, that's who Bloom was. But that's kind of reversed in recent years, I'd say. But has there been any pushback against your work?
I'm not an academic, first of all, so I don't. I've spoken at the James Joyce Centre and at the symposium in Antwerp and at the James Joyce Summer School. But in the early days, early days about 10 years ago, there was some resistance. But it's kind of, it's not so obvious now. I mean, look at, if you put your head above the parapet and say that an obscure, well, not a obscure, but that an unknown Dublin salt merchant is the real-life model for one of the most provocative and controversial Jewish characters in literature, I mean, you're asking for it. You're going to get you're going to get taken out, metaphorically speaking. But, I mean, from the get-go, I was very encouraged by Neil Davison, by John Hunt and by Professor Cormac O'Grada, who wrote Jewish Ireland in the Age of Joyce, and by Bruce Stewart of the Recorso website, and by Luca Crispi, and by some others. But to be honest, to be truthful about it, most academics were indifferent at the best, you know. I mean, I think those who get Altman, the Saltman, if you like, are younger people, students, younger academics, journalists, and particularly, would you believe it, women. For some reason. I mean, I think it's because many academics are still possessed of a mindset moulded by new criticism, and they cling to the view that Joyce, you know, was disinterested in politics and had but a totally superficial knowledge about matters outside of literature and aesthetics. And I also think that one's reaction to Altman the Saltman depends very much to a great extent on one's own political views, because Joyce was a political writer. He was tremendously humorous. His command of English was just exquisite. But he was a political animal. And, you know, Robert A.M. Adams in my book there says in his political writings that Joyce in his political writings, he says, sounds like a disciple of the citizen. And even today, scholars are divided on Joyce's political writings for Il Piccolo della Sera. You know, do these writings represent his views? I must tell you a story. Years ago, a gentleman from Dublin, he kind of suggested in a roundabout way, well, he says it out quite bluntly, he suggested that I was trying to foment a hoax. He said that it was utterly preposterous to imagine that anyone would believe that there was a Dublin Jew who had connections to the Invincibles, to James Stevens, to Arthur Griffith, and whose father had died from poisoning, and whose son had died after all the rest of it. Usher's Island, you know. I had to take a step back. It was almost like a verbal assault, you know. And many years later, in fact, just 2 or 3 years ago, I met him in O'Connell Street, and he came up to me and he shook my hand and he very graciously apologised. And he said, you know, he says, I've taken the trouble to go through the newspaper archives. And he said to me, do you know it's all there? The story is, you know. And I said, well, yes, that's true, of course. And he said, well, I've moved on to Finnegan's Wake now. He says, do you know why? I said, no, why? Tell me. You ruined Ulysses for me, he said.
What?
I said, Mike, my goodness, I'm terribly sorry. So you see, in the final analysis, it's up to the reader as to whether they factor Altman the Saltman into their reading experience. I mean, you don't have to. It's not compulsory. There are many levels to read Ulysses. I mean, you can read it kind of superficially, and or you can drill down into the text and explore the extra textual like what we'd be doing. But yes, I think a lot of people's problems with Altman the Saltman is that it confirms their worst fears. When you take a look at the Cyclops episode, you see this absurd suggestion that Leopold Bloom gave the idea for Sinn Féin to Arthur Griffith. Now, if you want to amuse yourself during a lockdown, read all the critics, how they've attempted to square the circle on this particular quotation, and you will be in stitches laughing around the place. You know, you'll almost end up in the puzzle factory, because they have tried for over 100 years to make sense of this. And the intelligent ones don't deal with it because they're afraid. Some of them say, well, it's a kind of an awkward attempt at irony, perhaps, you know. Or, you know, if you left that out of Ulysses, Ulysses would be a better book, because it just kind of queers the pitch, if you like. So, you know, there's something curious at play here, which we haven't encountered before. You know, is Joyce teasing us from beyond the grave? Perhaps he censored his letters that mentioned, and of course, Joyce and the Joyce estate have a great reputation for censorship. You know, might Alfred Hunter be code for Albert Altman? That's another possibility. Are the Altmans cited steganographically in the works? You know, I don't know. I'm just putting it out there. What do you think, Kelly?
What do I think? Based on reading your work in particular, like it seems like, and we'll get into evidence here because we've made these grand assertions, so now we have to back up what we're saying. But I found your work extremely convincing, just because there does seem to be, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, but then, you know, also like real world evidence that like the Joyces knew Altman and that he was, you know, their families knew one another. And Joyce based so much of Ulysses on people and events and places that he knew, or, you know, that he got information on from other sources. It seemed really odd to me that, you know, such a central figure wouldn't be. Like, it would be way weirder for Bloom to not be based on someone that Joyce knew at least somewhat well than for him to... I think I've gotten lost what I was saying, but yeah, no, I think it makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
You know, there's absolutely no evidence in Joyce's work or his letters. There is no reference to Albert Altman. Mm-hmm. But again, we return to the fact that if Joyce was so well informed mm-hmm. about events in Ireland and Altman was seldom out of the headlines, how can we reconcile?
Yeah.
So there must be another element to it. And of course, you speak about circumstantial evidence. Of course, we're not in a court of law. We're dealing with literature, yes. which deals with the imagination and mm-hmm. all sorts of stuff. So, although I'm putting it out there, I'm sitting on the fence myself because, as I said, I'm not an academic and I can't spend the remaining years on the planet trying to square the circle on this. So I leave it to you and the
I would say sometimes too when there's a really calm, you know, there's a like a clear question, like especially with that reference to Bloom and it was Bloom that gave the ideas for Sinn Féin to Griffith, is kind of a perplexing sentence. I think in part because Arthur Griffith was kind of an anti-Semite, so, you know, and it just seems weirdly out of character for Bloom. Like, trying to find an answer to that, you can do all these mental gymnastics and try to make it work, but I do enjoy, like an elegant solution, you know? It's a sort of, what is it, Occam's razor? Like, it's the, you know, it's this is the simplest solution, like, draw a line from A to B, rather than trying to do, and I mean, yeah, with literature, like, there, a lot of it is imagination, a lot of it is based on interpretation, but... Joyce is kind of stands out as someone who based so much on his biography and his experience. He really did want Ulysses to be a certain kind of accurate. It makes sense to me that he would bury all these little clues to real people that his family knew in Dublin. So,
well, first of all, you know, all of the commentary on Arthur Griffith since Ulysses was published highlights his anti-Semitism at the time of the Limerick boycott of Jews. And that is very, very true. But in recent times, there's been lots of work done on Griffith. And of course, it was known way back to the 1940s. But Joyce scholars ignored this fact, and I'll tell you. Griffith had a Pauline conversion of sorts, if you pardon the unfortunate pun. In 1909, Griffith became very pro-Jewish at the time of the formation of the Judeo-Irish Home Rule Association. And in his publications from about 1906 onwards, he's very pro-Jewish. In fact, his closest friend was Michael Noyack, another famous Jewish Fenian. And in my view, Joyce wouldn't have stuck with Griffith unless this change had come about. And you mentioned about hints in the text. Now, I'm going to deal with a lot of these in my own YouTube pieces, but I invented this term, coded psychotopographic allusions. And a few years ago in Trieste, one very nice academic lady said to me, she said, "I know what you're trying to get at, but why don't you call them submerged citations. And that was good. But I'm still not sure that that conveys what I'm trying to say. I'll give you one example. Now, there are loads of examples in Ulysses. In the Cyclops episode, a Michael Geraghty of number 29 Arbor Hill owes Moses Herzog, a Jewish sugar merchant in of number 13 St. Kevin's Parade, he owes him a sum of money, as we know from the start of the Cyclops episode. And we know that James Joyce, he mined Tom's street directory for kind of local colour. But in 1976, in the James Joyce Quarterly, a gentleman called Hugh B. Staples, in a piece called The Setting of Ulysses, he suggested, I don't know how it got into his head, but he suggested that Joyce had a specific motive for choosing these individuals and their addresses in Stony Batter. I mean, it's totally bizarre that just Joyce honed in on these two individuals. And Staples suggested that by the time that Joyce had begun to write Ulysses, Arbor Hill Prison had become the resting place of the executed 1916 leaders. Now, I agree with Staples on this point. I think it's a very important point. And indeed, there are many submerged citations of the Rising to be found in Ulysses if you know where to look for them. Anyway, that was the best Staples could do to explain Joyce's choice of 29 Arbor Hill and 13 St. Kevin's Parade. In fact, St. Kevin's Parade is not in Arbor Hill at all. It's in Little Jerusalem in Clambrassa Street. But anyway, you know, but I was left asking the question, a bit like that O Lieber and Stoller song sung by Peggy Lee, is that all there is? I just felt instinctively that there was something more. This was before I did a lot of my own research, because I knew that all our family came from Stony Batter. Why pick on Stony Batter? And then a few years ago, I was examining the Dublin electoral rolls, and I saw, intriguingly, that my great-grandfather, the salt merchant Mendel Altman, had an address at 28 Arbor Hill. Now, you must admit, that's an astonishing coincidence. Few people would say that was a pure happenstance accident. And then I examined the electoral rolls further, and I found that my great-grandfather Mendel had a property at number 12 St. Kevin's Parade.
Huh.
So this was one door out from the two addresses in Ulysses. And my friend Senan Maloney calls this, he's doing some research on this sort of thing himself, he says Joyce suffered from next door syndrome. And I agree with him. But why would Joyce have known this? He would have known this because, of course, his father worked for Dublin Corporation in compiling the voting register. He got odd jobs for the corporation doing this. Now, if you were very pedantic about the whole thing, you might say, but Moses Herzog was a salt merchant, was a sugar merchant. He wasn't a salt merchant. But if you go to Ulysses on the Liffey by Richard Ellman, you'll see on page 123 of the Cyclops episode, Ellman says that Joyce identified salt as the contrary of sugar for the Cyclops episode. So you have Mendel Altman, one address out, and a salt merchant, and a Jewish salt merchant at that. So, I mean, as I said, I'm sitting on the fence, Kelly.
Yes. Okay, yeah, that's kind of what I meant by circumstantial evidence. Like, it fits, it's logical, but does it prove anything? I don't know. But
It depends on the reader. I'm quite convinced that there are many readers who, for whatever reason, will put Altman the Saltman to the side and say, that's not going to be part of my reading experience. But like one lady said to me, she said, well, I didn't like Altman's politics, so I tried to ignore him. But she said, it was like when I got a tooth out, my tongue kept looking for the hole in my teeth, in the gum. She said, I couldn't get away from it. There you go.
When I researched, you know, the idea of who was the real Leopold Bloom, I came away from it feeling like this is many people kind of rolled into one. This is like a Frankenstein character. It was he's such a well-developed character. There's so much depth to him compared to many other characters in Ulysses that it seems like Joyce took inspirations from all over, from people he knew in Trieste, from people he knew in Dublin, and yeah, kind of stitched them all together. And it does feel like, especially just like the biographical details of Altman really fit. And then there's other details within the story, like the names, especially Sissy and Edie, show up in Ulysses. So I think like Ulysses is not a story about Altman the Saltman, but I think that his spirit is in it, mixed in with many, many others. Does that make sense?
Indeed. Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think commentators and readers and scholars. So yes, it's part of a composite. And the best you can do is to simply itemize them off, have a look at their lives, and try and spot, parallels or correspondences. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, who needs to know who a fictional character is based on? I mean, a writer doesn't need to know the individuals personally. I mean, Shakespeare didn't know Julius Caesar, but he wrote a play about him.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's something I've discussed with other folks, mostly off the podcast. But in most literature, it doesn't matter. But I think if you're happy just reading Ulysses and liking Leopold Bloom for who he is as a fictional character, that's perfectly legitimate. On the other hand, if you're going to do a blog and a podcast that sort of digs down into these things and answers these little questions I have in my head, then, you know, you end up spending a lot of time with the people in Joyce's life, because it seems like it was really important to him that he portray Dublin as he knew it and the people as he knew them. So it definitely adds insight into Ulysses, in my opinion, although I don't know that you'd need to do it for every piece of literature in the world. But
I hope not,
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, but I mean, Joyce did. It seems like he did like extensive like research, I guess you'd call it, of like a lot of correspondence with family and friends in Dublin. Like, where was this located? Who was this person? What did they do? And that he did that level of digging when he wrote Ulysses. So if you want a deeper understanding of Ulysses, that seems like, to me, like an important part of gaining that understanding.
It was said to me one time, it's a bit like the discovery of the Dark Lady of the Sonnets by A.K. Rouse in the 1970s. I mean, when that hit the Shakespearean world community, it was hailed as a great discovery, because there was definitely something in it. But then this pendulum swung back and A.K. Rouse went out of fashion a bit, and now it's kind of working its way back again. So I'm not sure if Altman the Saltman might be a bit like that.
Yeah. Well, I'm really excited to talk about him anyway. He's really interesting to me. Let's see here. You mentioned your coded psychotropographic illusions. I hope I'm saying that correctly. Did you talked a little bit about that. Were there any other that you wanted to mention or share, or are you going to save that for your own YouTube series?
Well, I'll save next door syndrome for my I'll give you one more then. You know that Altman's daughter, as I said, moved to Strand Road in Sandymount. She's directly facing Leopold or Stephen Dedalus on the Strand. It's about 100 paces. And when he's on the Strand, picking his nose, if that's what he's doing, and there could be children watching.
he does worse things than pick his nose.
If he's doing that, he's looking at Mim Altman's house. Or no, he has his back to Mim Altman's house, and he says rear regardant. He looks around. Can anybody see me? He says. Is anybody watching? You remember that particular phrase?
Yes.
Now, if you look at the Thom's directory, she lived next door to James and Greta Cousins, where he did stay. So I don't know whether that's a bit spooky or Have a look at it on the map.
Yeah.
We'll get it's very spooky.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I will definitely do that. Cool. All right. Well, then we mentioned your YouTube series. So
yes.
I've kind of worked my way through all the big questions I had for you here. So right. I'll give you a chance now to kind of plug your own upcoming work, which I am very excited about. Tell us a little bit about your YouTube series and then anything else you want our listeners to know about your work.
Well, I've nothing more to say, really.
Well, what I mean by that is if they want to read your writing or see your YouTube videos, how can they find you?
Oh, yes. Well, this year, I was scheduled to speak at Omni Scientific Joyce in Trieste last year. So it was suggested that we put our pieces out online or print them or get them published in some way. So I have 3 YouTube videos coming up this year. Well, perhaps 2 this year and 1 next year for the 100th anniversary. And I'll be dealing in great depth with all the subjects we've discussed here. And it's a kind of a half academic piece and half sort of documentary with a little bit of fun thrown in. So I hope at that point that I'll have covered everything about Altman the Saltman.
Yes. Oh, well, we're happy to have had you on the show. And those videos, though, I want to make sure those are available on your or will be available on your YouTube channel. How can folks find you on YouTube?
Well, I don't really have a channel as such. Well, we haven't worked all that out yet.
Okay.
I presume maybe you can put a link from Blooms and Barnacles.
Yes, that's what I want to do.
Well, if you really like to host the entire 3, you're more than welcome. But I presume if anybody just searches Altman the Saltman and Leopold Bloom, I presume they'll eventually find their way to them.
All right. Well, I will make sure when they do come out that we will share them on our social media and we'll talk them up on the podcast because I think they're, an interesting little avenue and Joycean studies, I guess you could say. Vincent Altman O'Connor, thank you so much for giving us some of your precious time. This was really, really enjoyable for me. And like I said, I am thrilled to have had you on our show.
Well, Tá fáilte rud, Kelly.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A lowly peasant girl, what brand with shame the Cragan's ancient name. No, sooner shall she part with life than come before the world as his own wife. With life, can I sufficient courage find to harm a girl so gentle, so gentle?
Thanks for listening to the Blooms and Barnacles podcast. Your support means the world to us. You can subscribe to Blooms and Barnacles on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Stitcher, Spotify, or any other place you listen to podcasts. You can also stream our episodes at our website, bloomsandbarnacles.com. That's bloomsandbarnacles.com. If you've enjoyed our podcast, you can do one of 3 things to help support us. Number 1, please donate at bloomsandbarnacles.com. The PayPal donate button is at the upper right-hand corner of the page. This helps us pay for coffee and for hosting fees. 2, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or the podcast app of your choice. This helps more people find our show. And 3, share us with a friend who you think would enjoy Blooms and Barnacles. Blooms and Barnacles is also a blog. We post new articles and original artwork semi-regularly at bloomsandbarnacles.com. Never miss an update by following us on social media. Search for our group Blooms and Barnacles Podcast on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at BarnacleCast. You can also send us an email at bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. That's bloomsandbarnacles@gmail.com. We met some of our favorite podcast friends through random emails and social media DMs. We'd love to hear from you too, so don't be afraid to shoot us a message anytime. We'll be back in your feed in 2 weeks. Bye for now.